Hello, everyone.
Welcome to episode number 5 of Chilled and Killed, a true crime podcast where we discuss a crime over a glass of wine or two. We're your hosts, Sam
and Amanda,
and this week we are discussing a story about a 21-year-old girl who took a drive through the mountains of New Hampshire and was never to be seen again.
For this week's wine, we chose 19 Crimes Hard Shard. Crack her open. All right, let's see what our crime is.
So for this crime, we got number 6, stealing from furnished lodgings.
So number 6. The interesting fact for number 6 online is, so the stealing from furnished lodgings would be blankets, bed covers, and sheets were woven, stamped, or taped with LCC, which was London County Council, to deter theft.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, on the front of this label, it's of a woman, so maybe she was stealing those things for her children. I don't know.
Maybe. But maybe she just needed bedding.
Yeah, right. It looks like her name is Jane Castings. At least that's what the picture on the label shows. It looks like registration number 789. So, Jane, what did you do? You stole some bedding. Sorry that you got shipped off to Australia for that.
Yeah. So again, we'll do the Living Wine label app and we'll put it on our Instagram. So be sure to go follow us at Chilled and Killed Podcast on Instagram. And you can see a little video of what Jane's crime is.
Sounds good.
All right. And the back of the bottle of this one, it starts out the same way as the last one did, talking about how they're sentenced to live in Australia rather than death. And after that ends, it says, approximately 20% of the prisoners banished to Australia were women. They served equally hard time and were instrumental in the founding of the nation. 19 Crimes Chardonnay honors their brave contributions with the boldest expressions of Chardonnay we could make. To learn more about this and similar stories, please visit us at 19crimes.com. And download our Living Wine Labels AR app. And just so we're all aware, this is called Hard Shard because it is a 16% wine, which is insane.
Oh, that is pretty insane, especially for a white.
Yeah. So wish us luck. Oh, my goodness. And I don't really like Chardonnay, so I'm gonna do my best tonight. So
I love Shard.
Cheers. How's it smell?
Okay, so we have discovered that we are very terrible at actually explaining what the wine tastes like in a scientific way or in a way of a sommelier.
Yeah, we just go, it's sweet, it's a little good. Dry.
We like it, we don't like it, and we give you guys no actual information about the wine, so we apologize about that. We're still trying to learn it ourselves.
Yeah. So from here on out, we're going to do our best to incorporate a little bit more actual wine information about the wine.
Mm-hmm. So one of the first things that you should look for is the aroma of the wine.
I don't mind the aroma of this one, I'm not going to lie. It smells fruit forward.
Whatever that means.
Would you agree? It has a fruity smell. It doesn't smell... I don't know how to describe that, actually. I was going to say, it doesn't smell dark, but, like, what the hell would that smell like?
I don't know. It smells like just a regular Chard to me.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to skip the aroma.
Yeah. We're still working on that part.
We'll get there. You guys will learn with us. So right. Let's go have a sip.
Okay.
She hates it, by the way, her face.
Oh, my God.
No? So, Panda, what don't you like about it?
Okay, what I don't like about it, off the bat, is it tastes like Chardonnay.
I like it.
It's okay, so here's the thing. I would have, prior to us trying to get better at this. I would have said that this was not sweet, but I'm wrong. It is a sweet wine.
For a Shard, this is sweet.
Yeah, it's not, you know.
It's dry.
But it's not too dry. Maybe it is an off dry.
We have discovered that we also have to talk about the sweetness levels to it. So this would probably classify as an off dry. It's not, I wouldn't say it's as dry as most Shards, but it's also not a sweet wine.
Right. It's, I'll drink it. And I know I say that every time.
Ooh, who are we kidding? She's just drinking it because of the alcohol percentage.
Dude,
not the 16%.
Actual. Okay, come on. Because the last one we did, which was the Sauvignon Blanc, that was 12%. So this is extremely high.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what'd you say the body profile? So apparently wines are classified as light body, medium bodied, or full bodied. What would you consider this as?
Full bodied or medium bodied? It's not light bodied.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. I think it might be medium-bodied. I think it could be in the good food wine range.
I was going to say light.
Really?
Yeah.
You think it's... I did a little one of those, put it in your mouth for a hot second, and I got a very, very oaky taste.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I was going to say when we first smelled it that I do smell it having that oaky flavor. She really hates it. She just stuck her tongue out again.
It's so oaky.
I like it.
I don't know why I want to drink something that tastes like wood. I like fruit-forward wine, thank you.
Well, I will have her portions of this.
Good luck after you.
I will also be staying in her spare bedroom for the night.
This thing is no joke.
Okay, so what would you say about the finish of it? Is it smooth, tart, bitter? What do you think?
It is smooth.
Okay. I was going to say the same thing.
Okay, good. All right.
We have agreed on one thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've talked about the aroma. No, we really didn't.
Not really, because that's not something I've fully understood yet.
Yep, we'll get there. We talked about the body profile. She thought it was more medium-bodied. I thought it was more light-bodied. And then we both agreed that it was more of a smooth finish. And kind of on the drier side, but a hint of sweetness. Okay, so are we ready to get started about the story of Maura Murray?
Yeah, all right, let's get into it. Well, she was born on May 4th, 1982 in Hanson, Massachusetts, to her parents Fred and Lori. They got divorced as Maura was growing up, and she lived primarily with her mother, but she still had a very close relationship with her father. Both Maura and Fred shared a love of hiking and being outdoors, and they would take trips to New Hampshire to hike and spend summer vacations camping with the family. Maura had four siblings, two older sisters, Kathleen and Julie, an older brother, Fred Jr., and a younger brother, Kurt. She graduated from high school in 2001 and was accepted into West Point Military Academy, which is a four-year military school in West Point, New York. Maura was a star athlete. She loved the track team and running cross country, and she also did great in school and maintained good grades.
Maura met William Rausch, referred to as Billy, while she was at West Point, and they started dating. They were known for having a great relationship, and most of their friends and family referred to them as the couple who were engaged to be engaged. Although they seemed to be that picture-perfect couple, some others speculated that their relationship wasn't as great as it was made out to be. West Point was a very prestigious military school, which was hard to get into. This school strongly adhered to the Cadet Code of Honor, which is, a cadet will not lie, cheat, steal, or tolerate those who do. So, when Maura was caught stealing makeup from the commissary at Fort Knox while on a training expedition, it was a direct violation of the Code of Honor. Instead of being expelled, Maura was lucky. She was allowed to transfer out of the program and into the UMass Amherst program for nursing. Which, to be fair, was also a selective program. Unfortunately, even though Maura left West Point to move away from the trouble she had created for herself, she had a way of finding herself right back into more trouble once again at UMass.
In November 2003, Maura stole a credit card from a woman in her dorm. When the other woman noticed unauthorized charges appearing, she contacted the police, who in turn contacted the restaurant the charges were made at. It just so happened that the police were looking into it when a call came into the restaurant again and used the same stolen card information to place a delivery order. so they followed the delivery order back to the person who had stolen the card, which was Mora. Mora was placed on probation, and the judge ruled that the charges would be dropped if Mora paid the money back and stayed out of trouble for 4 months. Seems like it should not be hard, but if she did get into any trouble with the law, then she would be charged accordingly, which would likely be identity theft and credit card fraud. Having these on her criminal record could become a problem in the future, because they do a background check and it could potentially cost her a job opportunity, so she definitely had to stay out of trouble until at least February 2004.
Mora and her father Fred remained close throughout her life, and he would come see her at college on her weekends from time to time. Fred visited her at UMass on Saturday, February 7th, so they could go car shopping. Mora had a black 1996 Saturn, but it wasn't in the greatest of shape, and she really didn't like driving it unless she had to. Part of schooling for the nursing program required driving off campus, so Mora really needed to get a more reliable car. Both Fred and Mora were hoping that they could have time to look over the weekend, and by that next week, they would have a new car. They went out looking for cars that Saturday afternoon, and went to dinner in downtown Amherst that evening. Mora's friend Kate even joined them for dinner. After dinner, Fred wanted to head back to the hotel where he was staying, but offered to give Mora his car for the evening. So Mora was actually the one who dropped him off at the hotel and went back to campus with Kate. When the girls got back to campus, they went to a dorm party with some of their other friends. They were hanging out and drinking, and then Mora decided for some reason that she wanted to return the car to her dad that night. However, he wasn't expecting it back that evening, and Mora had been drinking, so it wasn't really in her best interest to be driving.
Mora told the friends she was with that she wanted to head back to her dorm, so at around 2:30 in the morning, Mora left the party. She actually got into her father's car and attempted to drive it back to the hotel, but she ended up hitting a guardrail along the side of the road, and it caused around $8,000 worth of damage to the car. Somehow, police did respond, but no charges were filed. Luckily for her, because this would definitely count as getting into trouble in the eye of the court. Mora got a ride to her dad's hotel, and she told him what happened. Fred recalled that she was extremely apologetic. She was upset, but she was okay. And he said that if this is the only trouble your kid ever causes, then you're pretty lucky as a parent. Mora called her boyfriend Billy at around 4:50 in the morning on Sunday on her dad's cell phone to talk to him and tell him about what had happened. Billy consoled her, but he also noted that it seemed like more was on her mind than just this accident.
Fred called his insurance company on Sunday, and luckily they told him that the accident would be covered. Fred needed to drive down to Bridgeport, Connecticut for work, so he had to rent a car and then drop Mora off at her dorm. At 11:30 that evening, he called Mora to remind her that she needed to pick up an accident form from the DMV. She agreed to call him back on Monday to go over the forms and fill them out together. On Monday, February 9th, Mora made a few calls to a few different people. Notably, in the early afternoon, she called a couple who owned a condo in Attitash Resort in Bartlett, New Hampshire. Mora's family did travel to the Bartlett area frequently, but never stayed in that particular condo. The call was quick, too. It lasted about 3 minutes. And Mora didn't book any stay due to the short notice of booking, and this condo did not operate like any hotel, so they required more notice in order to book that actual stay.
After Mora called the condo, she then called one of her classmates, but no one is entirely sure what the call was about. There's speculation that Mora was giving away her scrubs, but others also just speculate that she was returning borrowed scrubs. Then Mora made another quick call to the number 1-800-GO-STOW, which is a number that helps hotel booking in the Stowe, Vermont area. But we now know that the number at the time was experiencing technical difficulties, and Mora wouldn't have been able to use it to book anywhere, but rather was just able to listen to the recordings. Mora also sent an email to Billy that said, quote, "I love you more, stud. I got your messages, but I didn't feel like talking to much of anyone. I promised to call today, though. Signed, love you, Mora." And then she also called Billy and left a short voicemail saying something like, "I love you, I miss you, I want to talk," according to Billy's mother, at least.
At this point, Mora also emailed some of her teachers, as well as her boss, to let them know that she would be out of town for a few days due to a death in the family. Interestingly enough, there wasn't a death in the family, and no one knows why she would make up such a story. But Maura did pack up a few items in her dorm room, almost making it look like she didn't intend to come back to school. She packed her things into boxes and even took artwork off the walls. Some think it's possible, though, that after returning from winter break, she had never fully unpacked her things. I guess this is something we might not ever know. But besides packing up her room, or not, on Monday, Maura did pack basic things to take a trip, such as clothing, toiletries, her birth control, her textbooks, her cell phone charger, a stuffed animal monkey that her father had given her, a diamond necklace that Billy had given her, as well as the insurance forms for her dad. And then around 3:30, Maura left campus in her car.
Maura stopped at an ATM and withdrew $280, which was almost all of the money in the account, and then drove to a local package store to pick up a bottle of Bailey's, a bottle of Kahlua, a bottle of vodka, and a box of wine, all of which is seen on the receipt found in her car. Now, I've heard many times people speculating that this was a lot of alcohol for one person for the weekend. And maybe this means that she wasn't alone or wasn't planning on being alone. But the wine is just that. It's wine. So it's a drink all on its own. And the other three, Bailey's, Kahlua, and vodka, they all mix together to make a mudslide. So to me, it's not crazy that she just wanted to make a mixed drink. But nonetheless, when Maura left the package store, she headed north. We know Maura checked her voicemail on her cell phone at 4:37, and this is the last time on record that Maura used her phone. We really don't know much about Maura's drive north, not until the accident at least, but we can assume that she likely drove Route 113 from Amherst and then got onto I-91 North, headed towards New Hampshire, and then perhaps got off the highway to get onto Route 302, which has a junction point with 112. Locals would know to take Route 302 in the winter to get to Bartlett rather than taking Route 112, which eventually turns into the Kinkamangus Highway. Now, I know it's not pronounced that way, but that's how we always pronounce it, but it's really the Kinkamagus. But either way, the Kinkamagus Highway is a very beautiful but also very windy road, which while technically the faster route, it can become a very dangerous route, especially in the winter weather conditions.
Either way, that's a lot of numbers and routes, and for the most part, it's not really that important. But what we do know is that sometime after 7 p.m., Maura lost control of her car and ended up in a snowbank on Wild Ammonoosuc Road, also known as Route 112 in Woodsville, New Hampshire. The entire drive from Amherst should have taken Maura about 2.5 to 3 hours. So if she left school around 3:30, and we account for about a half hour at the ATM and package store, the timeline sounds about right. Not too long after 7 p.m., a woman named Faith Westman heard something outside of her house. She and her husband Tim live on Wild Ammonoosuc Road by a sharp bend. When she looked out of the window, she saw a car stuck in the snowbank and not too far from the house. Around 7:30, Faith called the Grafton County Sheriff's Department to notify them that they could see a car in a ditch, but were unaware if there were any injuries. She also said that she could see a man in the vehicle smoking a cigarette, but that couldn't have been Maura because she was very against smoking. Later, the Westmans couldn't agree on what they saw. Faith thought that it was a man with a cigarette, and Tim thought it was a woman with a cell phone, and that the red light was from the phone. That seems like it could have been more likely.
I agree. So the neighbors that were across the street from the Westmans were Virginia and John Marote. And they also saw a car from their kitchen window, and they recalled it having its flashers on and someone walking around it. And then they watched as one of their other neighbors showed up in a school bus, Arthur Butch Atwood. So Butch lived with his wife down the road, still on Wild Ammonoosuc Road, but he was closer to the Bath town line. And he was on his way back to his house after dropping students off from a ski trip. When he drove by Maura, he noticed that she was alone, but not injured, but that she was clearly cold and shivering, so to be a kind neighbor, he stopped and asked her if she wanted him to call the police for her. Maura told him not to bother and that she had already called AAA. And then Butch offered to let Maura wait at his house until help arrived, but she told him that she wanted to wait in her car. Butch is a large man, about 350 pounds. He's older, around 60, and he has a mustache. So Moore might have been intimidated by him because of all of this, but he was concerned and told her at the very least that she should at least turn her car lights on so she doesn't get hit by another car. And then Butch drove down the road to his house.
Butch was pretty skeptical that Moore was able to call AAA because they had terrible cell service in that area. So when he got home, he did decide to call 911 himself. He didn't get through right away, but finally at 7:43, he was connected. He told dispatch that while on his front porch, he could see down the road, but not Moore's car, and that he did see a few cars passing by his house, but didn't see or hear anything strange. 3 minutes later, Haverhill police arrive on scene because of the call that originally came in at 7:30. Butch could see this from his house, so he decided to go back inside. And he estimated that around 7 to 9 minutes passed from the time that he left Mora to the time that an officer actually arrived. On February 15th, 6 days after the accident occurred, Sergeant Smith filed a report stating, quote-unquote, evidence at the scene indicated the vehicle had been going eastbound and had gone off the roadway, struck some trees, spun around, and came to a rest facing the wrong way in the eastbound lane. When Sergeant Smith approached Mora's car, he discovered that it was locked and that there was no sign of Mora. Also, the driver's side of the windshield had cracked and both of the airbags had deployed. It had been maybe 10 minutes since the last time someone had talked to Mora, and now she was gone without a trace.
Upon further investigation, the officer on scene found the box of wine in the back seat of the car and red liquid that had spilled onto the driver's side door and ceiling. But the box was damaged, so maybe in the accident it had just been jostled around and spilled. Shortly after, they discovered that a Coke bottle had a red liquid in it and it smelled of alcohol. But oddly, none of the other bottles of alcohol that Mora had purchased just a few hours earlier were found. Based on the wine, or whatever it was, in the Coke bottle, people speculated that Mora might have been drinking before the crash. But Butch reported that she did not seem intoxicated to him when he spoke to her, and there's really no real way to test this anyways.
I feel like sometimes people can get away with not sounding or, like, displaying behaviors if you're just having a conversation. So that could have been an easy way to just be like, no, she wasn't intoxicated, because she could have easily played it off that she wasn't.
Yeah, and they had a very short interaction.
Yeah, so that might not be the best report, but...
Agreed.
So besides the box of wine found in the car, they also found a AAA card, insurance forms, gloves, CDs, makeup, printed directions to both Burlington and Stowvermont, and a book. To me, some of those things, actually mostly all of those things, seem like they could have always been there, like the gloves, the CDs, and maybe even the makeup. What's not normal was to find a rag that was stuffed into the exhaust of the car. Mora's dad said that the rag likely could have been something that came from her trunk, along with a few other emergency roadside items that she had in a kit in the trunk. But it's really not clear why there would be a rag in the exhaust pipe, as that would only lead to negative effects such as stalling the car. Her father also thinks that it could be likely that Mora would have possibly put the rag in the pipe to stop smoke from coming out and attracting attention. But either way, it's still a weird occurrence.
The officer checked with neighbors briefly to see if they had seen anything that could help them, and then they went to Butch's house. Both the officer and Butch drove around the area searching for Mora, but with no luck. They didn't find any trace of Mora in any surrounding area. And by 9 o'clock that night, Mora's car had been towed to a local auto shop. The temperature that night got down to around a freezing 25 degrees. The next morning, Tuesday, February 10th, the police issued a BOLO, a be on the lookout, for Mora Murray, and described her as being 5'3". 120 pounds, dark hair just past her shoulders, and wearing a dark coat. She also likely had her cell phone with her, as well as a black backpack. Around 3:30, Fred got a voicemail on his home phone informing him that his car was found abandoned in Woodsville, New Hampshire. But he was at work and didn't get the message until around 5 o'clock p.m., which is when his daughter Kathleen called his cell phone to tell him that his car was abandoned. But more importantly, Mora was missing.
Fred immediately called the police in New Hampshire and insisted that a search for his daughter be started. They told him that if she was not found by Wednesday, that a search would begin. Honestly, I'm a little disappointed that this wasn't taken more seriously right away. From Monday night to Wednesday night is a long time, especially when it's involving a girl who's outside with just a jacket during February in New Hampshire, and in an area that she's not super familiar with. This should have been taken seriously immediately. Either way, at around 5:15 p.m., Moore was finally referred to as a missing person by the Haverhill, New Hampshire police, but it still took 12 more hours before a formal search began. On Wednesday, February 11th, 36 hours after Moore's car had been found, the search began. Fred had arrived to New Hampshire earlier that morning to help with the search, and went to the scene of the accident to find any clues. It hadn't snowed since the accident, which would have been helpful if searching for footsteps, but unfortunately, nothing was found.
All of Moore's family started to make their way north to help search, including her boyfriend Billy, who had taken a leave of absence from the Army to help search. Unfortunately, Moore's mother, Lori, wasn't able to join the search. She had to stay back home at her house in Hanson, Mass., because she had a fractured ankle, so she just waited anxiously by the phone for any news. Her family was decently familiar with the surrounding areas, as they had all vacationed up there during the summer vacations. They were all handing out flyers and posting them wherever they could, asking everyone they saw, but no one had seen Maura. The police assembled a team with canines to search the ground, trying to track Maura's scent, as well as a helicopter to search from above, trying to see footprints in the snow, which would have already been about 2.5 feet deep by this time of year.
The search didn't turn up any significant clues that would help create any leads, but there was one scent dogs picked up on from a glove in her car. The dogs led the investigation about 300 feet eastbound to an intersection. Then it came to an abrupt halt. The end in the scent makes investigators believe that perhaps Maura got into a passing car. The police started interviewing and questioning her family, as well as Billy and his family. They asked Fred if Maura had any recent traumatic events in her life, and he made note of her hitting the guardrail with his car, but said it wasn't really that big of a deal. At this point, police are now speculating that Maura intentionally did something. Maybe she was suicidal. Maybe she wanted to run away. They didn't have any evidence to show that foul play was involved in her disappearance. So, they were not too concerned about finding her.
The next day, Thursday, the police issue a press release listing Maura as, quote-unquote, endangered and possibly suicidal, and maybe in the area of the Kinkamagas Highway. By now, the police can see that neither Maura's credit cards or ATM card had been used since Monday, and neither had her cell phone. They tried to trace her phone using the GPS in it, but either there was not enough service or the battery had died, and they were not able to trace it. Fred told reporters in an interview that this is very unusual and not like her to just take off. He pleaded with her in saying, "I don't know what the matter is or the trouble you think you might be in, but this isn't anything we can't solve. It's me. You can tell me. We'll work it out until we solve it."
With no new leads to go off of, the Haverhill police suspended their search, but Fred was not about to give up just yet. He continued searching on his own and even started heading to Vermont due to the close proximities of the crash site along the Wild Ammonoosuc Road. Fred discovered that Vermont police knew nothing about this case, which is crazy considering how close they were. You would hope, especially for a missing persons, that they would have at least alerted the surrounding areas. On February 19th, the police launched another search of a 2-mile radius with 3 canines and a helicopter. But again, the search yielded nothing new. And while there was nothing more they could do to actively search the grounds, the police were still finding more background information and other possible leads.
Unfortunately, Maura's family and friends had to start returning back to their normal lives. Maura's possessions were returned to her family, and while Fred had to check out of his hotel and return to his normal life, he didn't give up and would return over the next year many times, determined to find Maura. Fred talked to a local man named Rick Forsier, who reported seeing Maura the night of the accident. He, too, lived on Wild Ammonoosuc Road, not too far from the scene, And he said that he saw a woman that fit her description running on Route 112 eastbound on his way home from working in Franconia. He said he didn't tell the police right away because he got his days mixed up and thought it was a different night. But then when he looked back at his paperwork for work, almost 3 months later, he realized the date and then told Fred, who contacted the police. So then again, another team of canines and officers were sent to search the area. But again, nothing new was found.
In June 2005, New Hampshire State Police went to Maura's sister's, Kathleen's, house in Hanover, Massachusetts, and requested that all of the items that had been found in Maura's car, which had been released back to the family about 2 weeks after the accident, be returned back to the police. The police also took the hard drive from Maura's computer from her dorm room, which had been in storage. They said that major crime units from the state police were getting involved and they wanted to conduct forensic testing on the car as well as on her belongings. I'm pretty surprised that this wasn't actually done in the initial investigation.
Me too. This seems like something that would have been a no-brainer. I do think it was a poor choice on their part to not have done that from the beginning.
Totally agreed. Fred continuously attempted to have the New Hampshire State Police ask for FBI involvement in this case, but the New Hampshire police refused to do so. In late 2005, a team of retired police officers and detectives, known as the New Hampshire League of Investigators, volunteered to help look into this case. They can't technically access the confidential files, but they heavily look over the information already released and interview witnesses or people involved on their own. One of the team leaders, John Healy, a former New Hampshire State Police officer, explained that it is their job to be a middleman between the police and the family, and help the family understand more clearly what the police are doing internally.
After a year of the team reviewing the case, they organized a two-day search in October 2006. They had canine teams in six different areas within 5 miles of where the car was found. Healy explained that 95% of homicide victims are found within a 5 mile radius of where they were last seen, so they wanted to make sure that that area was thoroughly covered. They searched surrounding gravel and sand pits because those are an ideal spot to dump a body. Fred was intent on searching an A-frame house near the scene of the accident because for some reason he thought it was connected. He got permission from the real estate agent because the house was currently on the market. And surprisingly, on the first day, a cadaver dog indicated to something on the second level. They called in more cadaver dogs, and they seemed to smell something in the downstairs closet, mostly. While the dogs are capable of smelling decomposition, there was no body located. However, they did remove some items from the house, and a piece of carpet from the closet. They had it tested to see if the stains were blood, and if there was any DNA on it matching Maura's, but the results have not been made available.
Fred has since given up hope with work done by the police due to their shoddy work. He believes that they didn't do what they were supposed to and have been covering up ever since. So he continues. He is searching for Maura and any other clues on his own. Basically, as it stands right now, there's about 4 main theories about what could have happened to Maura. The first theory being, Maura might have staged her own disappearance so she could create a new life. The second theory, Maura was driving her car in a second car with someone she knew was driving ahead of her, and when she crashed, they came back and picked her up. The third theory. Maura was afraid that she would get a DUI and wandered off into the woods to avoid the police, then got lost or disoriented and froze to death. And the fourth theory. Maura has been kidnapped and has yet to be found.
Do you have an opinion? Do you think any of these are the one that is true?
So I'll start with kind of reverse of that. I don't think she staged her own disappearance and created a new life because she seemed like she was really connected to her family, and I don't think she had really any reason to run away from her family. And besides for like tiny little run-in was with the law, like I feel like nothing was really too terrible in her life where she needed to start anew. Like that just doesn't make sense to me.
Agreed.
Two, there is like that huge theory that, like, she was picked up by someone and they were, like, supposed to meet somewhere, and we didn't really discuss it too much in this case, but when other people have talked about it, it just seems so far-fetched that I can't buy into it.
The only thing to me that's supporting that is the lost scent at the end of the road. Like, yeah. A dog did track it to the end of the road, and then all of a sudden it's gone. and she managed to disappear fully. I mean, granted, it was nighttime, but she did disappear fully from view in 10 minutes.
I totally agree with that, and I think, to me, that makes more sense for theory number 4, where she was kidnapped and something bad has happened to her.
Truth. Okay, yeah.
So, I could so, like, I don't see her just, like, jumping into a car with a friend, and then, like, something happens with her and her friend, and, like that. I feel like somewhere that story would have come about. Like, it makes sense to me why the story of her being kidnapped and, like, not being found is still so hidden, because people don't know that side of it.
Fair. And I'll admit that, like, I don't think, you know, she, if somebody she knew was driving a car ahead of her and then saw her crash and then came back to pick her up, like, there's no evidence at the package store that somebody else was involved back in Amherst, so I don't know who it would have been. And I don't know how another person would have been able to keep it under wraps for so long.
And you probably would have seen some sort of, like, tire tracks or, like, footmarks. And Butch and Faith and her husband, I feel like, would have seen another car.
Right, because they were looking out the window for, you know, a solid half an hour.
Yeah. I mean, like, I know he said he saw some cars going back and forth, but, like, I don't know. I feel like they would have seen something more pronounced, like, there.
Yeah. Yeah. And for the third one, where she got, you know, was afraid that she was going to get the DUI, so she wandered off into the woods and then got lost or disoriented and froze to death. You know, that's all great and dandy, except for the amount of cadaver dogs, the amount of searching that they did in the surrounding woods, the 2-mile radius, the 5-mile radius. There's no way she got further than that at nighttime in February with 2.5 feet of snow.
I totally agree. I think that they would have found something by now.
Agreed. Plus, if nothing else, they would have been able to track footprints because of the snow. And it exactly. didn't snow over them.
Yeah, so they would have picked up on something. And the fact that they didn't pick up on... I think the biggest thing was they picked up on the scent stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's one hard fact that we know.
Right.
But where did that scent then reappear? Because she had to go somewhere.
Right, but the dog would never be able to track that. So I don't think we'll ever know. And then the fact that the house, the A-frame house, I don't think that she would have been so close. Or if she was that close, say she broke into that house because she crashed, she ran away, she went into the house, whatever. I think her body would have been found in there.
I feel like there's still something connecting to the A-frame house. I feel like she got kidnapped from somebody and, like, we're still just trying to find out where she is.
Yeah, but why, if she was kidnapped, would they only bring her to the A-frame house on the road that they kidnapped her from?
Well, maybe that's why they didn't find a body, because she's not just there.
Maybe. Well, it's been many, many years, and we still don't know. So, I guess, here's the thing. I'll give you the updates, because all of this did happen back in 2004, and this is a very ongoing case. It is very involved still to this day. So, back in April 2019... the state police had a meeting with Morris' family and discussed their recent search of a home close to the area of the accident. The homeowners let the police search the ground in the area, but nothing came of it. And then they announced that they also searched the house, but again, nothing came of it. And then the most recent update would be in January 2020. So, like, days ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not really on board with this, because in the years since Maura's disappearance, her boyfriend at the time, Billy, had been named in several physical and or sexual abuse incidents, and they had been kept quiet, but now they're public information. And it's unclear if he'll now become a person of interest in Maura's disappearance or not, but just because somebody since 2004 has been named in a physical or sexual abuse incident, to me, it does not mean that he had any connection with Maura's disappearance, and even more so because he took a leave of absence from the army to go up and search for her, so he was accounted for, to my knowledge, in the time frame where she would have gone missing.
Yeah, I feel like that's a pretty good alibi.
I agree, so I don't know why this is a thing being brought back up. You know, honestly, unless there's something that I'm unaware of, but to me, that seems unlikely.
So, going back to the house, I'm still hung up on this a little bit, because there was also, so the A-frame house, it was sold and then rebought after that initial family that Fred was talking to lived there. So, police went to the new and jump in if I'm butchering okay. this.
No, you're good. But yeah, the police did go back to that house again with the new family's permission.
Yeah. And they brought in cadaver dogs, two different cadaver dogs, and the cadaver dogs also picked up on a hit in the house. So, like,
the same location as well.
The exact same location.
On two different... Yeah, they were not together.
Yeah. So... And to me, that's kind of, like, a huge thing. So, I think they're trying to investigate that a little bit more. Again, this literally happened days ago. Yeah. So, we have no information about this, but... If any information does come out, we will definitely be doing an update of this case.
Mm-hmm. Because it'd be really cool if we can do an update that gives you a little bit more information about this and to give a little closure.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like that's one of the biggest things right now is the family doesn't know where they stand. They don't know where Maura is. They don't have any sort of healing measure, like, because there is nothing that's closing this case.
Yeah.
So that's where we stand right now. If there's possibly anything that you guys know about Maura's case or disappearance, please contact the New Hampshire Division of State Police. They have two numbers that you can contact, the first one being 800-852-3411 or 603-846-3333. Or you can even email them at missingpersons@safety.state.nh.us with any information. So, on a lighter note, let's talk about the wine.
Yeah, let's bring it back. I will be honest.
She hates it.
I do. But that's not saying anything about the wine. That's a personal taste, because Chardonnay is not something that I like, and I went out on a little limb here trying to branch out, if you will. And so here's the thing. The warmer it got, the worse it got to me.
And I would agree with that, too. My glass is kind of warm right now, and...
It's kind of yucky.
Yeah. I mean, I started off wanting it to be colder, so now that it's warmer than it was, it's... Eh.
It's not better. We'll go there. But my problem is that since I did not like it, I was trying to drink it fast.
And she got all of the wiggles.
Oh, yeah. I got... I got all of the things happening to me, because I just did not like it. And for whatever reason, my palate, when I was drinking this fast, was picking up on a very strong, like, think the way wood stove smells. Great, right? Okay. But I was tasting that, and I didn't like it. But Sam was not getting that, so.
No, I was getting the normal, like, buttery, oaky, smooth Chardonnay taste. I do like this out of most shards, I think. I've tried that some that are a little bit better, but it's not a bad one. I think if you're a little bit more of an experienced shard, you can definitely try it. If this is your first shard, no.
Probably not.
Because Panda, clearly by her reactions and facial expressions, she did not like it.
I did not. But the wine is good if you like Chardonnay, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it's definitely buttery. Yeah. Like, it's definitely silky smooth on the tongue. Not, I wouldn't call it acidic. Like, I think it's opposite. Like, it's definitely like a buttery.
This was definitely not a full bottle kind of wine.
It's hard when it's heavy. I don't know if heavy is the right word, because it's not heavy like a red wine would be.
It's heavy for a white, though. It's not light and airy.
No. No.
No. No.
I will take my Sauvignon Blanc any day.
Well, at least we... Okay, so you have your white 19 Crimes. I have my white 19 Crimes.
Yours is easier to find.
True. But next, we have to bring in a red.
Yes.
So, after all that talk, we just want to say thank you so much again for listening this week. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Chilled and Killed Podcast, or send us an email with any questions, comments, or requests. You can email us at chilledandkilledpodcast@gmail.com, and we'll be back next time to talk about the wood chipper murderer. Until next time, bye!